I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Sarah Dye. Sarah Dye of a number of projects, but you might know her as Sarah Dye of Above Time Coffee Roasters. A couple of years ago, I had her on the show to talk about that business and her journey into our cause and our scene. And I reconnected with her last year in November at the American Renaissance Conference. It was great to see her again. I hadn't seen her in a couple of years. And we talked about getting back on the show. So I'm honoring that promise. Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's great to be here.
So we will be taking questions from the audience a little later. And I just want to let people out there who are listening know, though, that if you want to do the privileged, favored, best kind of questions, do it through Entropy Stream. Send a super chat. We very much appreciate that. The address is across the bottom of the screen. And what I want to begin with, Sarah, is just a little background. And the reason for that is this. It's been a couple of years since you've been on the show, and our audience has grown. There are a lot of new people out there who didn't hear the show we did a couple of years ago. So could you tell us a little bit about what you do and how you came to be, well, my favorite coffee roaster?
That could encompass an entire book, but I will attempt to give a summary. Prior to 2015, I was immersed in leftist anti-white culture in a small, kind of outside a small liberal town in Indiana. And I had grown up with the typical anti-white propaganda that most American kids get today. And there were a lot of things that I was completely, you know, unaware of as far as the truth about all sorts of historical events and, you know, the importance of having an identity, our struggle, all the stuff. I didn't know about any of it. And in 2015, I essentially had a very hard and fast awakening. A friend dropped this bomb on me one day, essentially, and introduced me to white identity. And at first I was, you know, concerned and oh my gosh, what's wrong with my friend? She sounds like one of these quote unquote, you know, neo-Nazis and whatnot. But, I had an open mind and she and her husband sent me links to articles from places like Your Establishment, Countercurrents, interviews from Red Ice. You know, I started just consuming all of this information and essentially my mind was blown. And I just went down every single rabbit hole essentially. And my husband was right there by my side through it. And it was huge. I mean, it is absolutely life changing. To give an example, you know, at the time we thought, oh, well, we'll just do the right thing that white people are supposed to do and only have two children, you know, like the idea of procreating and having a large, wholesome, happy family and all these things that they trick white people into thinking are not allowed or taboo. It was amazing. Looking back on it now, I mean, it's been well over 10 years ago and I'm a completely different person. And, I'm just so grateful. I'm so grateful that the friend introduced me to that information and, it has essentially continued to shape who I am and who I'm growing into. So, again, like I said, this is kind of a big question to answer and it could encompass the whole book. But, when I learned about this new wonderful thing of racial consciousness, one of the first things I wanted to do was share the good news with who I thought were my closest girlfriends at the time. And, that backfired terribly. I had no idea how, radically anti-white, many of my peers were, far more radically anti-white than I was. Far more feminist, et cetera. And it backfired and word spread. And in around 2017, we started to have Antifa, essentially anti-white extremists, which is the better term for them, began harassing us and targeting us at our local farmers market where my husband and I sold our homegrown produce, herbs, flowers, and my handmade textiles. We had been doing that for many years and it was our sole source of income. And, the situation worsened. There were many instances where I had to call the police and file reports against these people. And this was again, you know, we have a lot of newcomers to the movement, like you said, but a lot of people don't realize is that at that time, things were very different. We did not have, this new thing that we're seeing now where everybody's talking about, everybody's noticing what's going on. This was a different time. There were still, our anti-whites really had the upper hand in a different type of way than they do now. And it being in Indiana, also the particular Antifa group there was the Hoosier Anti-Racist Movement, also known as HARM, who had been involved in the violent Tinley Park attacks of 2012 in Chicago. So these are militant Antifa types who were known to do violence. And essentially in 2019, that situation worsened. It went from an occasional verbal altercation at the farmer's market and some stalking, slight vandalism and harassment, to a full-blown protest where Black Bloc Antifa was actually showing up to the farmer's market, protesting in front of our booth, intimidating our customers, making death threats to us online, promoting people to burn down our home and our farm, promoting our children to be taken away from us. And the reason why the situation escalated was because I had been a member of Identity Europa for a couple of years, which was a fantastic organization that is unfortunately no longer operating. It was a white identity movement that was inspired by identity, the European one. I can't remember the exact name. A Generation Identitaire, excuse me. And I had been a member of that, and there had been a series of doxes that had occurred from an anti-white extremist organization called Unicorn Riot. And I was essentially accused of radicalizing youth to commit quote-unquote hate crimes. And in our particular community, this dox became a super dox. The protests at market were going on. We were in the New York Times and in all of these leftist anti-white publications. And the whole I think idea of it with these people was that they really wanted to scare us and frighten us away. They wanted us to go into hiding. They wanted us to shut up. I had been producing content online under a pseudonym promoting traditional folk ways and European heritage and healthy living and lifestyle and things like that, using herbs for medicine. They targeted me in that way and essentially accused me of radicalizing youth. There had been an individual who had actually engaged in some illegal activity who had tried to join Identity Europa. And I had been asked to help with vetting that person. And they had committed this vandalism crime, I guess, a couple weeks prior to wanting to join the organization. And so, of course, anti-whites took that information and tried to connect me to the vandalism crime. And the whole thing was a mess. It was terrifying. And the worst part of it was that the city of Bloomington was collaborative with Antifa the entire time. They engaged in helping raise money for Antifa to be bailed out of jail should they commit a crime at market. They allowed protesters to break the rules of market. They allowed all of this nonsense. Even the city police department had tried to intimidate us by saying that they had received a credible sniper threat and that there was a sniper who was supposedly going to go on top of a parking garage and shoot us. And it all ended up culminating in a lawsuit against the city of Bloomington. We sued the city of Bloomington and the mayor for their involvement and support in all of this, essentially trying to suppress our First Amendment rights. And yeah, it was an absolute nightmare, but we endured it for years. The reason why is because I was so outraged that as law-abiding, peaceful people who had just gone to market for years, sold our produce, and never engaged in any illegal activity, never did anything wrong, but simply were proud to be white and in our own private lives, had a network and a community and were engaged in peaceful, lawful activism. For us to be those type of people and to have these evil people going after us the way that they did, trying to absolutely ruin our lives, trying to make us feel like we were not welcome at that farmer's market and that we should be afraid to sell our produce there. We were just essentially ignited to double down and to go back week after week and show our faces and keep smiling, selling our herbs, selling our produce. And so that's what we did.
I think that's a wonderful thing. They want to intimidate us into silence. And every time that a doxing blows up in their face, and instead of causing people to flee, causes them to get more militant, it really is a victory for us, and it's a defeat for them. It was in your hands to make this a defeat or a victory. Strategically, it's very stupid of them to do what they did, because it was entirely in your hands. It's like online bullying. It's strategically very stupid for you to stake your reputation on bullying somebody off the internet, right? Because the power to give you victory or defeat is in the hands of the other person. And if they just dig in, well, you've lost, and you dug in and they lost. And I think that's wonderful. I hope they learn something from that. Given that they're extreme leftist radicals, they probably didn't. But anyway, please continue the story. But I'm so glad to hear that you just made them resent it. And in fact, you got bigger and more open and more explicit. That's a wonderful ending to the story. And we're only in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's very true. And I'll be honest, you know, I was really afraid. I had never been on camera. I had never done any public speaking or anything like that at the time. And I was really wanting to just be brave and not let these people know that, you know, I was pretty scared. I was kind of scared to go back to that market each week. And we had local journalists with literally cameras in our faces every week. And they had my name and picture on the front page of the local newspaper at least 24 times, letters to the editor. I mean, it was obviously another tactic of intimidation. And yeah, I look back on some of the first interviews that I did and I kind of cringe, because I was still a little bit scared to say what I really wanted to say. And yeah, over the years, you know, I've just obviously grown out of that. I've been given more opportunities to speak, and, you know, I've tried to kind of, you know, formulate that part of myself, and not formulate, but excuse me, develop that part of myself. And mm-hmm. It's been an amazing opportunity, because as I fully came into myself with this movement, I've made lifelong friends and had such amazing experiences and had so many wonderful opportunities. And, you know, none of that would have ever happened. You know, so everything kind of happens for a reason, I guess. And yeah, we felt very guided just to kind of transcend it, you know, and mm-hmm. embrace and face, you know, face the challenge, face what was happening, and kind of rise above it, you might say.
Yeah. Well, that's another great point. A lot of times when people say something a little bit based and they come under fire, they face a choice and they think, well, if I apologize, if I retreat, if I go silent, if I curl up and go fetal, right, I'll keep my friends and my job and my position in the community and things like that. Whereas if I stand up for myself, I might lose friends. But the trouble is that if somebody is going to unfriend you, defriend you, to use that kind of social media terminology, if somebody's going to turn their back on you over something like that, they weren't really a friend anyway. And the people that you meet once you get into this cause become real friends, because they share your deepest values. And so people think of the fake friends or the false friends, the fair weather friends that they might lose, but they, because that's the bird in the hand, right? But there are some real friends out there in the bush waiting for you if you just persevere. And in the end, you gain, you don't lose. You lose false friends and gain real ones.
It's so true. It's so true. I remember talking with Sam Dixon, and he used, you know, this beautiful point of saying, despite all of the sacrifices that so many of us make, we really do live rich lives. And it's so true. You know, the friendships, the relationships, the experiences that we have when we fully embrace racial consciousness and white identity and find where we fit into this movement, because there really is a place for everyone. We really are living much, much more richly then these people who are living these fake lives, they're afraid to even hit a like emoji on a news article for fear that their community might see and accuse them of being, you know, white nationalists or something. I remember what that was like. But yeah, essentially, you know, a lot of these people, the anti-white extremists, they're so miserable, and they saw, you know, our family, living our dream. We had this, you know, 3.5 acre small micro farmstead, and we grew beautiful, truly beautiful food and flowers. And, you know, we created beauty. We brought beauty into the world, and, we were happy and healthy in a healthy marriage, healthy children. You know, these things are very much hated by these miserable anti-white extremists. And I'll never forget seeing them with their online chatter saying, you know, talking to each other, "Keep up the good work, guys. This might take a few weeks, but we'll get rid of them from market eventually." And, you know, when I read that, it was like just fuel. It just gave me fuel to give them the hardest time that we possibly could. So yeah, I was invited by Lana Lochtef onto Red Ice later in 2019 to talk about what was going on. That was the first time I'd ever been on, you know, any sort of interview. I was really grateful for her to bring awareness to what was going on with our situation. And from that interview, we actually received our first donation to put towards a lawsuit. So we were able to retain an attorney. And, you know, it's very frustrating because some people at the time, the movement, they would say, "Just sue them, just sue them." Well, a lot of people don't realize like how difficult and expensive it is to sue people, even when you're completely in the right and someone else is in the wrong. The way the system is set up, it's not easy. So, you know, we were able to retain this fantastic attorney who, you know, was honest and supportive. And we did fight them in court. It was a 1.5 year long lawsuit battle. And essentially, on the books, the system won. The judge ended up essentially dismissing it. He's well known for supporting LGBTQ and anti-white causes. So, you know, there's really no surprise there that he wasn't going to allow this to go to a jury trial, which is what we were seeking. However, I still counted it as a win because for over 2 years, the city of Bloomington was on spotlight, and a lot of people became aware of how bad this problem of anti-white discrimination is, and brought awareness to how corrupt the city was. For instance, in the deposition, they were able to discover that so-called sniper threat was false, that the city itself was using that as an intimidation tactic to try to scare us from market. So the truth was brought to light, and it cost the city a lot of money. So I still count it as a win, because I think anytime we're fighting back, there's some victory in that. And yeah, so after the lawsuit ended, that winter, we had a good friend, actually a mutual friend. I don't think he wants to be named, but he was visiting, and we were all chatting one night, and, you know, we were talking, and he said, how come I can't believe there's no like white nationalist coffee company yet after all these years? You would have think somebody would start that business. And we kind of were talking about it. And I mean, my husband and I have always been kind of what you might call coffee snobs. We really like good coffee. And we also kind of talked about, well, yeah, you know, but whoever would start something like that, they would have to be prepared to be doxxed, because of course they would. And you kind of looked at each other and were like, man, maybe we could do that. Like, we really love coffee. And we're already doxxed. So, you know, we don't have to fear anti-whites coming after us for this dissident-owned company. And the rest was history. I reached out to a friend who was a coffee roaster years ago. And he, you know, opened up and shared all of his insights with me about how to get started with coffee roasting. We looked into, you know, all the details of the business side of things and getting licensed as a roaster. And ultimately, we decided to go the mobile food truck route. So that's what we did. My husband and I outfitted a cargo trailer and turned it into a micro commissary kitchen with a stainless steel and everything that's required. And we bought our first coffee roasting machine and a couple of bags of green coffee. And we got busy roasting. So that was essentially how Above Time Coffee Roasters got started.
It's a great story. You took a bit of a break recently. Is that correct? Or, because as I recall, Above Time seemed to be, well, I didn't see your name associated with Above Time for a while. Did you take a break from the company? Did you step back from it and then come back to it?
Yeah. So we ran the company ourselves from 2022 until 2024. And meanwhile, kind of separate from the story of the coffee company, in our personal lives, as a homeschool mom who has four children, we have four children. I've been homeschooling for over a decade. Even though there were a lot of, I guess you might say, quote unquote, conservatives who supported us in our local area, we were still living far too close to Bloomington, Indiana, which is an absolute hotbed for anti-white extremism. And it was, you know, it was a long battle, Greg, but essentially it got to a point where I couldn't even go to a grocery store locally or a soccer game with my children without being harassed. Being filmed, I'm not kidding you, standing at the deli at a Kroger being filmed at one point in time by a woman who I knew was an Antifa adjacent person. And we needed to move. We went back and forth. Should we move? Should we not? It's very, very difficult to move. So we did move. We decided that there was really no reason to make our children spend the rest of their childhoods living in such an unfriendly environment. And, being ostracized from homeschool events and things like that, when there are plenty of other wonderful places to live in this beautiful country where they could have a happy childhood and not experience that anymore. And so we did. We moved to Tennessee. This is public knowledge. And we absolutely love it here. And we had to face a difficult decision of whether to continue on being the owners of Above Time Coffee Roasters. It is a food business. So a lot of people have to realize when you're running a dissident food business, the things that you have to go through as far as, you know, crossing your T's and dotting your I's are much more involved than say, you know, selling some sort of merch or soap or something like that. Being a food business, a lot more liability involved. And honestly, I had to step away from that particular role in the business. And I did sell the company to a very close friend of mine who has been an activist in the pro-white movement for many, many years. And he is now the owner of the company. And over the course of that year, we moved to a different state. And then just last year, I became much more involved with the company again, getting to do the part that is my absolute favorite part, which is being a cheerleader for our people and a cheerleader for our cause and getting to interact with people in person, setting up at events, serving the coffee, and all of that. So I couldn't be more thrilled. This project was kind of my baby, one of them. And so That's the reason for the break there in my involvement. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I saw you a couple of years ago, and you just got the news that you were expecting another child, and so you got four now. That's wonderful. So you went from two to four, and I understand that in the past you did a Hearth and Home podcast with a friend about homeschooling and I guess more broadly things related to child rearing and family life. And you mentioned that you're planning to bring that back. Can you tell me a bit about that side of your work and this project and how people can be on the lookout for its return?
Yeah, thank you. Several years ago, after the big docks of 2019 and that Farmers Market saga, I was chatting with my good friend, Carissa Pack, who is also a woman who's been involved in the movement for well over a decade, and who is also a mother and a homeschool mom. And, you know, we were like, oh, I'm so tired of these anti-whites slandering us and trying to characterize, mischaracterize us. And we thought, you know, why don't we start our own podcast where we use our own voices to talk, to say who we really are. And in addition to that, bring what we call this reviving folk vitality. So we like to talk about healthy living, homeschooling, taking back our identity as a folk, as a people, you know, reclaiming our ancestral heritage. And yeah, so we had a podcast for years doing that, and both of us had more babies and kind of got busy with other projects. And so we took a step away from Hearth and Helm for a while, and I'm excited to announce that we are actually going to revitalize Hearth and Helm, you might say. We're bringing back our podcast, and we'll have an accompanying blog with articles. And of course, one of our favorite things about the podcast is that we like to bring on guests. So other women who are in our movement, who are part of our cause, who share our values. And so, yeah, it's essentially, it's from the feminine perspective, but Hearth and Helm, the name that I came up with, is all about a balance between masculine and feminine. We think of the hearth as kind of, you know, the women tending the hearth, and the helm is, of course, you think of these explorers and the more masculine side of things at the helm. And essentially, Hearth and Helm is the balance of that, where we as women in this movement, in the pro-white cause, we need to tend our hearths, and we enjoy these traditional roles and traditional femininity. But we also understand that in this era and in this fight that we're involved in, we also have to, you know, embrace and acknowledge some of the hard facts of what face our people. And so, yeah, that's kind of the whole energy of the show. So it's not necessarily just for women. Some shows will be much more geared toward women, like essentially discussing, you know, women things like childbirth and things like that. But a lot of the episodes are also might be interesting or appealing to men as well. So we, yeah, and that's, you can find that on Twitter or X and Telegram as well for now.
So it's Hearth and Helm, and will you be doing Substack perhaps, or putting it up on Spotify, things like that?
Yeah, we'll definitely do Substack, and we'll try for Spotify, and we'll see how long that lasts.
Right.
Sure will allow us to be on there. But
it's always worth trying. Absolutely. One thing that I think is wonderful is overcoming fears of public speaking. You talked about that you went through that journey, and now you're really quite good at it. I think that that's remarkable. And it's just a truth that a lot of people would rather risk death than speak in public. And yet public speaking is one of the most powerful political forces in the world. We're ruled by silver-tongued persuaders, basically, or certainly a significant percentage of political power flows from the tongue, basically, from communication. And one thing I've always encouraged people to do in our cause is just get better at communicating by joining, say, Toastmasters, things like that. But however you do it, just get out there and try. And it's great if you can find like-minded people to bounce ideas off and try ideas out on and get feedback from. But I think it's for, you know, you're actually a very strong speaker, and it's really easy to have you as a guest on the show.
Well, that's a beautiful compliment. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I have come to enjoy it much more than I did early on. So.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to people out there in our movement who are thinking of starting their own business? And specifically, I guess the first question is, well, do I just start a business, or do I start a movement business and a sort of politically branded niche business? But what's your advice to people? In a way, that decision was made for you by the fact that you were being doxxed and harassed and became celebrities in our cause. How should people go about starting a business based on your experience? You've not just started Above Time, but you had a business before Above Time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I would for us with the coffee, it was something that to our knowledge, no one else was doing yet. So I suppose that would be my first piece of advice is if you're creating a business, well, what we like to say for our people, by our people, then, you know, choose something that's not already being done. Choose something where you might be able to collaborate with other dissident businesses. That's what Above Time does. We have our t-shirts, for instance, printed by Will to Rise and Avalon Concepts. We love collaborating. So those would be my first two bits of advice. The other thing is just make sure that you're, you know, you've got great insurance and that you're, you know, be prepared for, oh, anti-white entities to try to dox you, try to make your life difficult. So ideally getting your ducks in a row and being prepared for that is a good idea if you're not already doxed. However, if you are already doxed, like in our case, it just made perfect sense for us to move into this, you know, because the fear of being doxed was already gone. We had already gone through that gauntlet, ran through that gauntlet. So those would be a couple pieces of advice. And as far as just running a business that's sort of under the radar or implicitly white nationalist, I suppose, again, just be prepared for, you know, to be targeted, because you really just never know when it's going to happen. Like for in our case, with back with the farmers market business, I never saw a full on dox and protests and newspaper articles and things like that coming out. I never saw that coming. I was actually someone who tried to be extremely careful online. I was so cautious back in those days in chats and things like that, that I wouldn't even discuss the weather. I was so paranoid about getting doxed. That's about all.
Who in the movement has been influential on your thinking about our cause, and more specifically in your thinking about being a movement-affiliated business?
Oh, many, many, many people. So where do I begin? Lana Lochteff and Henrik Palmgren of Red Ice. Nathan D'Amigo, who founded Identity Europa, the organization I was first a part of when I first became red-pilled back in 2015. There were many people, including Counter Currents and other publishers such as Antelope Hill, Imperium Press, who's on the more cultural, spiritual side of things. Jared Taylor from American Renaissance, and now the people who are organizing Return to the Land. I mean, so many wonderful content creators and publishers have inspired me. But I would have to say definitely Lana Lochteff. She was the first woman who, when I first heard her interviewing these people and speaking so truthfully, back when I first became aware of racial consciousness and white identity, I was hooked. I thought, I want to be able to speak the truth like she is. And she has done an amazing job of platforming, you know, a bunch of little guys like us who, without, you know, Red Ice and what she does, our story may have never gotten out as well as it did. So, yeah. Recently, I heard at American Renaissance Leonardo Gianni speak, if I'm saying her name correctly, and she was fantastic. Another woman who was not afraid to get up on stage and speak her truth. So I certainly appreciate, especially when it's other women who are doing this, but many people have been inspiring to me. Dissident Soaps, for instance, they're an amazing adjacent business. We actually have a collaboration coming up with them, which is kind of exciting. We haven't announced it yet, but I will do so on this show. They're about to be producing a really amazing exfoliating soap with Above Time Coffee Soap. So. Yeah, we have a lot of really great businesses.
Do you think the U.S. economy is getting better at all? Being in business, I know you have to be somewhat mindful of these things. You notice these things before other people might notice them. Last year was a pretty tough year for Counter Currents in a lot of ways. And it just struck me that one of the main reasons, and I talked to some of our donors and longtime purchasers of products and things like that. And the big thing was, well, I'm unemployed or I just don't have any disposable income. Are you seeing any sign of a turnaround since Trump has come into office?
No, I being in East Tennessee, this is what I see. You know, if I'm speaking regionally from where I'm at and what I see locally, I don't think that it's getting better yet. But I do believe that it will. I hope that it will. However, better is subjective because, you know, for instance, utility bills, grocery prices, day-to-day items that people need, such as socks and shoes, just basic things like soap, household goods, those are all really expensive right now. Some things have doubled in price from just 5 years ago. And I'm not, and wages here where I live are extremely low, even for, you know, certified trades, they're lower than other areas of the country. Property prices where I live on average are still around $350,000 to $450,000 on average, but they go above that in other areas of Tennessee. So from my local perspective, I don't think it's getting better yet. Now, nationally, I don't really know, and I'm not an economist, but hearing other people's experiences and their perspective, they seem to be in line with what I'm seeing locally.
Weaving is another project that you do. You mentioned that you were selling woven goods at your farmer's market stall. Can you tell us a bit about that? I think that's kind of a very wholesome, folkish activity. And are you still producing woven goods?
Yes, I am. I took a break from that for a couple of years. I was roasting a lot of coffee and having another baby at the time as well. And so I didn't weave for a while, but I have actually been weaving, spinning, and doing natural dyeing for almost 20 years now. And I have this simple floor loom that I got many, many years ago. And the year before last, I got it out and dusted it off, and I have been weaving again. So I'm really enjoying that. It's very cathartic for me to have a creative outlet and a creative process. And it's just been so fun to share that, you know, with our people, with our community. I laugh a little bit because when I used the example earlier of how back, you know, over a decade ago, I was so afraid to get doffed. I remember at the time thinking, I wish I could share that I do this, you know, with these people that I'm meeting. But it's just so much has changed. The movement has grown and changed and shifted. The awareness of, you know, white identity has just, I think it's exploded, at least from what I'm seeing. And yeah, so things are different now, but I've been weaving a lot. I spin. We raised sheep for years. We had Shetland sheep years ago, and I still have all this beautiful wool from them that I'm going to be spinning up into yarn soon. And it is. It's a traditional craft that it's important to me to kind of keep that alive. I was actually thinking about maybe even offering some hands-on weaving lessons in the future here at our new little homestead in Tennessee. So we'll see.
I was just in Austria recently, and where I was staying was a neighborhood in Vienna itself, in the capital. And I was walking through the neighborhood over several days, back and forth, going to the tram, going to get food, things like that. And I kept passing all these shops that basically catered, I think probably 95% to women. And they were shops selling things like yarn and things connected with basically handicrafts, you know, quilting and crocheting and knitting and stuff. There were three shops within this neighborhood that I walked by. And at the same time, I noticed that even though the sidewalks were very narrow, they were very crowded with women pushing baby strollers there, and there were a lot of kids. And I thought, this is very interesting. These are concrete signs of a healthy society. And I'd never even thought of something like that before as a sign of a healthy society. But yes, I mean, the idea that people actually, you know, as a hobby, I guess, still make things at home, it indicates that primarily they're women who have a bit of leisure time, and they're probably producing things for kids and other family members, things like gifts. And I thought it was very wholesome and healthy, and it made me think of when I was a kid, because that was a thing that my mother's generation did. They you know, crocheted and made sweaters and made quilts and stuff like that. And for a long time, I saw no sign of that. It's like all of that just seemed to disappear basically and be replaced by cheap manufactured goods, primarily probably from the third world. So it's interesting to see signs that either that's coming back or in some places it never really died.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, what a beautiful experience and a beautiful vision that is. I'm glad that you shared that. The fiber arts especially, I think, has stayed pretty strong in Europe, from what I gather. But in America, I think it is making a comeback. And I think that people are going to increasingly seek out these hands-on traditional skills as things become more digitized and modernized. Yeah, so it's beautiful. I love to see a revival of that for sure.
So I have a couple questions here in the chat. And folks, if you would like to chime in, please do so. Archie sends $5 US, and he asks the question, why is kosher certified coffee metallic in its taste? I found Only Goodness brand tastes much better than Kicking Horse. The latter is metallic. I'm in Canada and assume that Above Time would be costly to order in Canada. Is that a yes or a no? So there are a couple questions there. Do they do any sort of strange, arcane bean torture to create kosher coffee?
Oh my goodness. Oh, I have no idea what all they do. From what I gather, the kosher certification is just a really hefty charge, essentially. It's a money-making scheme for these rabbis. It's absolutely a racket. I don't know why it tastes metallic, but what I do know is that our coffee is not kosher certified, and we definitely try to bring awareness to the racket that is kosher certification in America. It's absolutely ridiculous. Everything, almost every food in the store is, even dish soap is kosher certified. A lot of people don't even know how to identify it. Our coffee is absolutely not. We love bringing awareness to that. And it is also not metallic tasting. It's very fresh. We actually hand roast it. Our team hand roasts the coffee ourselves. So we are talking small batch, like 2 pounds at a time. So it's very much a human scale operation that we're involved in. No metallic taste, no kosher certification, and no bean torture. As far as shipping to Canada, he's correct. I think we're dealing with some issues with that right now, with tariffs and things like that, I guess. At least that's what a Canadian recently mentioned to me, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to ship there again sometime soon.
That's great. That's a great answer. No bean torture. And I can testify that the coffee does not have a metallic taste. I'm a big coffee snob, so I was very excited when you went into the coffee business, and I've very much enjoyed your coffee. I'm one of these people who like sort of medium blends or even light roasts, as long as they've got a lot of character to them. And that's what you've consistently delivered every time I've gotten your coffee. And it's always different, which I think is great. It's always different, but it's in a great zone. I also really liked the stoneware mugs that you created. Again, they were all slightly different, and they were all beautifully designed and heavy and nicely made. I can definitely testify that there's nothing metallic or Kabbalistic about the taste of the coffee. Let's see if there's some other questions here. Archie writes in with $5 US. Thank you again. We Canadian people say, if you call me a racist, then I don't care because I know that I'm not a racist. Nick Shirley said something like that. We must practice saying things like, if you call me a racist, then I don't care because I am a racist just like you. This is true. I'm not one of these people who wants to run away from the word racist, because that basically just allows that word to have this aura of dread that accompanies it all the time. If everyone flees from it, then it's scary and powerful. If people stop fleeing from it, then it's no longer scary and powerful, and people will eventually stop using it. And you can quibble about the definition. You can say, oh, I don't hate other people, I love my own, stuff like that. One way that I respond to it now is just to say, yes, but this is the good kind of racism, the kind of racism that protects people. And people will, you know, sort of be taken aback by that. Not necessarily in a ferociously hostile way, but they've just never heard that kind of approach to it. Like, oh yeah, sure, there's a bad kind of racism. I've seen all the movies. I've seen Mississippi Burning. I can recognize there's a bad kind of racism, but you know, there's a good kind too. And part of the usefulness of that kind of response is that it takes away the aura of unconditional menace and evil that our enemies try and attach to the word racism or any form of racial consciousness or racial preferences. For white people only, of course. It's totally fine when other people do this, but for white people, it's unconditionally bad. That's the message we're supposed to take to heart. And if you say, well, you know, I can grant that this kind of stuff that you see in these movies is a bad thing. It's distasteful. But there's this other kind over here that seems pretty good to me. Let's have a conversation about it. If you can get people to recognize that, yes, you can have a conversation, and that it's not unconditionally bad to have in-group preference, it can sometimes protect you, then you've basically taken this numinous, threatening, unconditional evil label away from them. And I think that that's actually a good thing. Racism is a sin, right? It's just always bad. That's how they want us to think of it. And then we all shrink back from being accused of this sin. But if you say, well, yes, it could be bad here, but look, let's look over here. This isn't bad. Some people would be alive today if they'd been more racist, for instance. If Irina Zarutska had gotten on that train and looked around and decided, I want to sit over here rather than over there, she might still be alive. So that would have protected her. So it's not always a bad thing. But I do think that that's a good point.
Greg, can I add something really quick?
Yeah, please.
I also think it's really important to inform people who are new to racial consciousness or the idea of it, that terms like racist and white supremacist and things like that are explicitly designed to dehumanize white people who prefer their own and who mm-hmm. are racially consciousness. And they need to dehumanize us in order to make us fair game for targeting and for violence. Like these young college kids who were protesting, for instance, our family at the farmers market, and calling for violence and things like that, thought that they were doing the right thing because they believed that we were evil because we had been called these terms, white supremacist and racist. So it's really important, I think, for people to be aware of the purpose of those terms and how they originated.
Yeah, they call us these things because they want to destroy us and lay the premise for destroying us. And if we can knock those weapons from their hands, if we can make sure, if we can slowly change the attitude of people in the community around us so that they can't rely upon people shrieking in horror every time they throw that word around, then we're changing the power dynamic here. And I think that we are changing that power dynamic. We have changed that. Now, a lot of people, they just roll their eyes. They don't care about this anymore. They think, you can call me whatever you want. I'm still not going to change my opinions because obviously the stuff that the left has been pushing is evil and destructive, and they're just trying to dress up mischievous and evil and destructive policies in a cloak of virtue by saying that their enemies are evil racists and they're anti-racist, they're anti-evil. And I just think the more work we do to drain that swamp, the better off we all are, the less vulnerable we all are. So let's see if we have any more questions here. Somebody says, shout out to Leonarda, and Leonarda's a gift to the movement. Yes, I very much agree. And Archie says, Red Ice is great propaganda. Propaganda is activism. Moving to a like-minded community is activism. What kind of activism do you suggest? And so that's a good question. When you moved to Tennessee, did you consciously try and seek out other like-minded people in your community? You were certainly fleeing from hostile people. Did you find people, or did you know people who were more like-minded before you actually made the move?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We consciously chose this location based on that as one of the factors. Not only is it beautiful and has a lot of pristine wilderness, which has always been something that's important to my husband and I, because we are naturalists and very into nature and hiking and all of that. Not only does it have that, but it also has a lot of like-minded people here all across this big, beautiful state. You will turn a corner and you will meet a fellow white nationalist. There's a lot of activism here. NOVA is an organization that I believe is based out of Tennessee. We're, supporters of them, and they're doing great work. There are communities that are getting established here. And also Patriot Front, another group we're fond of. They're, active here as well. So, and then a lot of just individuals, are sympathetic. A lot of people moved here from other states over the whole COVID era. To get away from anti-white leftist politics as well. So,
well, that's very good to know. What do you think of Return to the Land? I imagine you saw Eric at Amran like I did. Is there any kind of Return to the Land style settlement going on in Tennessee, or is there any talk of that?
There is certainly talk of that, and I do believe there are some plans in motion as far as communities getting established here. Now, I can't speak to whether or not they're affiliated with Return to the Land, just because I don't simply have all the details. But what I think of Return to the Land is, honestly, I think it's fantastic. For years being involved in this movement, a lot of people like to get into late night conversations about, let's all buy some land and move there together and start a community. And everybody wants that, but not a lot of people are willing to put in the behind the scenes, like legal work and things like that. And that's what I think is so great about Return to the Land, is that it seems like they're really setting a precedent as far as being able to do that sort of thing and doing it right and remaining, within the law and essentially, hopefully, untouchable by those who would want to destruct and destroy such communities. So I applaud them. I think it's fantastic. It's very inspiring.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Eric is fantastic as a leader and a spokesman. And I really respect the patient, meticulous legal groundwork that he and his team have put into this. I think that that's very, very encouraging. I liked this about you when you talked about the process you went through in creating the coffee roasting company. Do you do a food truck? Do you do this kind of thing? Because there are all these legal rules that you have to follow. There are all these different options. And I was just impressed with how rational you were in going about solving these problems and getting your ducks in a row. And I really respect that. There's all this moaning about the 1%, but there's another less than 1% out there. And it's less than 1% of people who are really capable of starting anything, like a business or a movement like Return to the Land. And it's great that we're getting people like you and like Eric and the rest of the Return to the Land people who can actually get things started and keep them going. That's very encouraging.
Thank you.
So we should wrap up. I want to go for just an hour. I know you've got beans to bake and things to weave and children to take care of. So can you, we just wrap up with a few final words and information for people who want to follow you on social media, who want to find you on the web, who want to buy your products and want to just follow you as a person in this greater cause.
Yeah, thank you. It's been such a great time to be on the show again. And I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much, Greg. So personally, people can follow me on X. I'm at Brave Vasilisa, a name which is inspired by the Baba Yaga folktale of Europe. At Brave Vasilisa on X, And then as far as my weavings and textile work goes, I'm on Telegram, and that's at Moon Woven. And for Above Time Coffee Roasters, which is the only white nationalist coffee roaster in America, and to check out what we do with our small batch, hand-roasted fresh coffee shipped right to your door, people can go to AboveTimeCoffee.com. You can also follow us on X, where we have a lot of fun. And of course, that's Above Time Coffee on X as well. And we're also on Telegram at Above Time Coffee. As far as Hearth and Helm, right now we are just on X. That's also Hearth and Helm on X and Hearth and Helm on Telegram. And again, we're just getting that started up. So thank you so much.
That is wonderful. Yeah, that's so great. And I'm really glad that we reconnected at AMREN. I thought it was a great conference for a lot of reasons, not just because I got to speak there for the first time, but because it was, there was a uniformly good slate of speakers, and there was just a really nice feel to the whole event. And there were a lot of interesting people there with tables like you and like the Return to the Land folks. And so I came away with a very optimistic feeling about how this cause of ours is moving forward. I think that we're becoming a real community. And it, with each passing year, it becomes less virtual and more organic and real. And I just think that that's a sign of health and longevity, that we've got a future in us. And it's great that, you know, your family's growing too. Again, that's the sign that we've got a future as well.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I'm very much full of inspiration for our future.
Well, Sarah, thank you again. And I will definitely have you on again for another time. And I very much appreciate your time today. Take care.
My pleasure. Thank you.